Hello and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon recording from downtown Nicosia, and with me in my virtual studio from Luxembourg, I have Myriam Dalal, a cultural practitioner, writer and researcher. Welcome, Myriam.
Hi, Magda.
It's lovely to see you after a few months. And let's start the conversation going, because we've got a lot to talk about the fact that you've actually worked as part of the UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage Unit in Paris. Please explain to me what intangible cultural heritage means.
Sure. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm very happy to be able to be in a conversation on intangible cultural heritage, because a lot of people actually have this question. It's always difficult to find a definition for the practice, but like very simply speaking, it's all the know-how and knowledge and heritage practices that we manage to pass from one generation to another, be it culinary practices, be it folkloric songs and dances, be it how we do things. So it's actually not related to the material nature of the element that we produce. It's how we produce it. So it's always passed through a human element. And this is why we focus on the bearers, we call them, the bearers of the practice. So the people in this practice are the most important part. When we talk about intangible cultural heritage, it's always...
And there's no limit.
Okay. There's no limit.
Okay, so I think this is a good place to start, because you're presently working on a project with grandmothers.
Yes.
And we all know that grandmothers are such a treasure trove of stories and information. So I think that's a good place you can start telling us about what it actually is.
Sure. So I'm working here at the University of Luxembourg as a postdoctoral researcher in public history. I wanted to work on a subject that is related to the country itself. So Luxembourg, for those of you who don't know, is a country where a lot of different nationalities live together. And it's been the case since 70, 80 years. And when we talk about immigration, people who made this place their home, we cannot but talk about the Portuguese migrants, because they are here since the 70s, 60s. There's 30% of the population in Luxembourg who speaks Portuguese. So it's a very big group.
Yes.
So I wanted to work with the Portuguese migrants, but I also wanted to work with the generation that was able to start here from the beginning, make the city what it is now, and then pass it on to different generations. It's usually when we talk about migration that we go to talk to the men who were here, and whether for work, for labor, industries, deindustrialization, all of these practices. But then for me, what was important is to talk to the grandmas, because
Can I interrupt you there? But that's what always happens. We always talk about the history, what the men did, and the wars that were won. We always forget what's happening in inverted commas, the background. And it's actually not the background. It's actually what keeps everything going.
Exactly.
The women, the mothers, the daughters, the sisters.
This is exactly why we chose, like, public history, by definition, is a practice where you don't go to the history books to learn about history. You go to the people. And the people are the ones who are going to talk about their own history, which makes part of a bigger collective. So when we started the project, I was like, let's go to the grandmothers. These people are the ones who went out grocery shopping every day, who talked to their neighbors, who passed the recipes, who transferred things, who also did a lot of work with different groups in different practices. Mm. Let's see what they have to say about the city, how they made it here, how they were able to raise their kids, how were they able to talk their language with their grandkids.
And how were they able to integrate? How were they able to integrate?
It's up to them.
Mm.
Yeah.
And at what stage are you with this project? Are you at the beginning, or are you
So now we're actually midway. We did the interviews with the grandmas. I've invited two artists, one who's Portuguese living in Switzerland, Duarte Peri, the other, Marie-Céline, who's Dutch, has been living in Portugal for 5 years. So they're coming here and they're going to be working with me because I have a background in fine arts. We're going to be working together on interpreting these audio interviews into installations. Made with lights and different materials for us to put in the city and to present to the public in September. So we're actually in the creation process now.
Okay, so to put the listeners into the picture, you're also a visual artist. So it's not just the stories, it's actually interpreting the stories with things or words or photographs to actually bring them to life.
Yes. Some people might be aware of the practices currently with contemporary art are a bit distant from the public. Like, we have to be very knowledgeable in certain terms and culture or certain practices to be able to understand what the artists are talking about. And this is not something that I was interested in. So for me, going to work with the people is going to help one make it closer to the public. And then when I'm interpreting it, going out to the streets to present the work is also another way of going about the boundaries of the museum, the gallery, the language, and all of this. So it's very important to bring the art to the people and to make it as much engaging and easy and
To stop
personal.
it, and to stop it being elitist, because a lot of the
Yeah.
time art is seen as, well, I've got a PhD in fine art, or I'm an artist, and I understand the brush strokes and whatever. I remember I like art. I grew up in a very artistic family. I'm not very artistic with my hands, and I always used to take my son with me. He was little, and he used to look at me, he was little. I said, you know what, we'll make a deal. We'll go and we'll stay as long as you're happy. When you're getting bored, we'll leave, but don't trip over it and do it in the beginning. And again, he said to me, Mom, what am I supposed to be seeing? And I'd say, what are you seeing? There's nothing you
Yeah.
have to be seeing. What are you seeing? And it was a really, at first, it was a good process for me because it got me out of the, but it's also a good process to see a young eye looking at this thing. And I think that's what you try, that's what we all need to understand, that art is not for the elite. Art should be for all of us,
It
regardless
is
of
not.
what, where, or what level we are on.
Yeah, and it's amazing, like the example you gave with your son when you went to the exhibitions. When he asks, "What am I supposed to see?" This is a question that everybody asks. Like, people feel intimidated when they're looking at an
Yes.
artwork because they feel like there's a message that I'm not getting. Is
I'm
there
missing something.
something? Yeah. Am I too ignorant to get what this dot means and what this color means? And this is very wrong. And it's very saddening that the art that was supposed to be a liaison between us and everybody else is becoming something that is keeping us from talking to people. So, yeah.
I remember working, walking into my friend's art gallery, and there was a very suggestive piece of artwork that everyone was scared to talk about. And my son looked at this piece of artwork and just blurted it out. And everyone got such a shock, but he actually said what he saw, that everyone else was too polite to be talking about. But that's what he saw. So I agree with you. We've got to bring it to the people. No, it's artwork is very personal. And subjective.
It
It's very
is. It
personal,
is.
subjective. You and I met in March when you came to Cyprus as part of a project called Belonging, and how the pace of migration has changed the way we make memories. Just very. I came randomly because the curator is a friend, and I'm always interested in memories and art. I was blown away, to be honest, by your work, by the work, and I forgot to name the lady that did the faces of the woman in the hijab. Every piece of artwork in that exhibition was extraordinary and different. Tell me your experience, because we're also going to go to one particular piece of artwork that you produced during that exhibition.
Yeah, so for the exhibition Belonging, as when I saw the call for participation, I was very hesitant at first to participate because like I am choosing the goals that I want to participate in because of the what I just said. Like I don't want art to be elitist, and I don't want to be dragged into something that nobody's going to understand. So I wanted the freedom to express myself, but I also wanted a format in which I could just tell a story. And it was like it was really beautiful to be able to get in touch with Shirin Zarati, who was the curator for the show, because when I talked to her, like she was on the same points that I was interested in. And she was someone who was really open to discuss different formats. And she was also someone who knew that when we're talking about migration and displacement and experiences of immigration, it's very easy to slip into being a victim and not having agency over your own story. And I didn't want that. And she knew it, and she was very aware of it. Like coming for as a woman who's either, say, for me, it was because I'm Lebanese, or for her, because she was Iranian, there's always this connotation that's going to be dropped on you. Like, oh, Iranian, do you want to talk about the women and their status? No, it's not always the case. Sometimes we just want to tell our stories that connect to any other story everywhere else. And this is what I liked about the call. And I was really happy with the way it was presented, either online or on site in Nicosia.
But I agree with you. A lot of the time, when you female migrant, a lot of the time, you immediately label the victim, and it shouldn't be like that. Sometimes you are, but that's not all you are, because you can actually take a certain amount of control of your life. The piece of artwork or the installation that drew me to you is your love story. The fact that you actually, and I like if a love story, love is such a beautiful word because it's limitless and it's got multiple dimensions. And your love story, I particularly identified with because it's not necessarily a love story of a migrant. It's actually a love story of the new world.
It is
So,
it's a
Lala,
really
so
nice.
let's start to make the intangible tangible now,
Yeah,
please.
it's a really nice way to put it. It is a love story that might be a bit weird to explain if we weren't in 2024. Like I'm in a relationship with a guy who's living abroad. I am not able to go see him because of his visa status. He's not able to come see me because he cannot acquire a visa to come to EU. So the situation is like this. We haven't met physically, but we've met in other formats of the digital world. If I were to explain this 40 years ago, nobody would have gotten what I meant.
She's
It's
cuckoo.
you have an imaginary friend.
Exactly.
But because of the world we now live in and the mediums that are open to us to explore, there is this dimension of affection of you're there with someone, like you follow up on their life, you're present when they need you, you talk to them, you share your stories with them, your daily life, everything else, like the bit of details, and you're there, but actually not physically, in every other way that is possible to you and that is open to you given the circumstances you're in. And this is practically what I wanted to tell in the story. It's a 15-minute story. I talk about how very, like very, at various points we came about close to meeting, but then we never did, and how we are navigating this as if it was a dance. But we're not dancing together. We're dancing apart. It seems that sometimes we come close to meet, but then we don't. And then we continue to dance because life is, for everyone who's in a circumstance of displacement or movement, it is a dance. Like you cannot stop. You don't have the luxury to stop, actually. So you're moving from one country to another, from one city to another, but then you're trying to make a life amidst all of this. And this is what the story tells.
And how long has this been relationship? How long has this relationship? When did this relationship start?
It started in July of last year. So we're
Okay.
almost at our first year anniversary.
Okay.
It started July last year, actually. So I'm also an arts and culture reporter for a magazine in the Arab world. And I got in touch with him because he's an artist. I wanted to interview him for a subject that's related to something that I've been working on the art scene. And this is how it started. Like, I actually contacted him by email, going like, I wanted to interview. We have such and such questions. And then we moved to WhatsApp to try and follow up on when is this happening, because he was moving at that time, so he wasn't able to do the interview. So we followed up on WhatsApp. One thing led to another. And I'm like, hey, by the way, I have a crush on you. And as I said in the piece, thankfully he also felt it. So that was the starting point.
Okay, and when you're a 21st century human being, you actually also understand the question of trust, because trust takes time to build it, but it can be built. Okay, was the trust immediate?
I think, and also this is like very personal for me, because I didn't realize it while I was walking into it. I was like,
Okay.
I just need someone to talk to, and he's going through what I'm going through. So it might just be a space where we have conversations on. Because I was in Rouen in France, and then I moved to Portugal, and then I moved to Luxembourg, and then I went to Lebanon, and then I had my visa processed, and the process was delayed, and then like it was chaos. And amidst all this chaos, there was this point where I looked and I'm like, oh, there's a person there, and he seems to be going through what I'm going through. And this is where like it was built. It was built, but
And sorry,
I
can I
went into it
interject?
just.
Can I interrupt you? And in all the instability, he appeared to be a stable, a consistent presence in your life.
That's true. Even though he was also in an unstable situation, so the dance, like the dance describes it perfectly. He was dancing, I was dancing. We were constantly moving, let's say whirling, as if the world is whirling with us. But then I managed to like to fix it. Like I, this was a point, and I wanted this point to stay still, even if it wasn't.
Okay. No, it's actually very important because migration is movement to the extreme, but a lot of us have movement in our lives, and often when there's an inconsistent, consistent presence, you actually know, well, I can reach out to Thomas and or M Marion, and she'll be there and she'll just listen to me. So it's a new way of it's not a new type of relationship. It's a relationship that fills a different need that we now have in our lives
True,
because the
but
world is so fluid.
let me add on this. So I could have found the spot in someone else who was like close to me, one of my friends, one of my family members. But for me to be able to share with them, I felt a burden where I was like, do I want to give them more worries? Do I want to explain something that they're not aware of? And then at least this person, he knows what it's about. He's in it.
Yes.
And this is where like you start from the connection, discovering the other. Like we have something in common, and from this point we're gonna start and uncover what this person is and what I'm actually feeling.
And in fact, this is part of intangible heritage because stories are being passed on or relationships are being passed on.
It is like your whole memory, like it's like you open a box that is non-existent, you feed stuff into it, and then this box travels, even if it's not actually traveling. It travels from your space to his space, and then he could pass it on through his networks. So it's always nice. I love storytelling because it's this. You take a piece of you put it in someone else. And then this someone else, either it changes his life or he passes it for others, that it becomes something else. It's not It's not yours, it's all of us.
But I do that automatically. I'll go into a space and people will be speaking, and I'll immediately ask a question or throw in a personal memory. I do it naturally. And sometimes I need to check myself because I think, you know what? Not everyone is here for that.
Yeah.
Some people are just here to listen to what this person is saying, and I'm being totally interruptive or disruptive for no apparent reason. But to me, there's nothing we have until now underestimated the value of storytelling, both to the contribution of what it brings to society, but also to our sanity.
It's true. I have a friend who's working on her PhD. It's about the godmothers during the First World War in France. So for those of us who don't know, the godmothers are the women who were in touch with soldiers during the First World War. They would write to them letters to keep them going, like to try and follow up with them. It wasn't an affectionate, like it wasn't always an affectionate relationship. It's just like the soldiers needed someone to be there for them. So these letters were sent back and forth between these women and these men. And it's actually like the practice is what made them live or continue to
To
live.
carry on,
Some
it
of,
gave them the will to carry on.
yeah. And it's like if you look at it from the perspective of what we're living or what we're going through nowadays, the war is no longer something that the men only are subjected to. Us women are also going through our mini wars and very personal wars. And in that, we also need a connection. And it could be just a story. It could be just to take our minds off of things, like learning about what someone else is doing somewhere else sometimes helps you dream. And dreams are free, like at least for now.
And
Like when
dreams
you.
are free, and dreams actually make you lighter. When you dream, it takes you're not stuck on the ground and weighed down with responsibilities and death and whatever. And dreams lift you up. It's like a balloon that lifts you up slightly and makes you a bit lighter.
It is. It is.
Okay, tell me a little bit. I mean, I could carry on this kind of. I love the story about the godmothers, and I think the more I hear and the more I delve into storytelling, because I happened on podcasting randomly. I worked for a community media center as a volunteer, and then they brought in a radio station, community radio station, and they said to me, do something about women. And I started doing everything about women, but not everything about women concerns me. Okay, and I started doing about peace building, because peace building brings with it the stories, it brings with it contributions, the needs, the loves, the whatever. So, and to me, the storytelling is, the more I work into it, the more I realize how many dimensions of history have women involved and they have not been heard because their stories were not considered important.
True. And it's like this brings us back to the work I'm doing with the grandmothers. When we went to these interviews and we asked them questions, the women were like, is this
Important.
important? Do you think I should say this? Do you think this is gonna help? And I'm like, say it. Say it. And they're like, sometimes they stop at the details and they're like, oh, so I used to go picnic here. And then they're like, you don't need to keep this. I
I want
do,
to.
trust me, I do. Because this is how we know now that people go to this spot because you used to go to this spot. People use this spot and it's more public because for you at first it was a family practice and then people joined you. And this is how this area became more public and more known to the public. You contributed to a bigger history. And it's very difficult to explain it at first because for them, they think like they're talking about something very personal, who's not gonna change anything. And then you go like, no, it is, it is. It
Very
doesn't
per
always have to be.
they think it's personal and unimportant, and yet it's what gives color to the rest of the picture. Or what the rest of the picture is one dimensional. The minute you throw these stories in, you get the three dimension, and that's where its value comes in. That's where its
It's
values
one that
come.
it's one dimensional and it has a lot of gaps. Like the history that we're being told has a lot of gaps. And until we get to find these absences and put them back to the public in a discourse where we go like, oh, by the way, this happened. There's not going to be any dialogue with the history. It's always going to be top down until we come and say, oh, this was absent. This was silence. Let's talk about it.
I mean, you're looking at, if you look at the simple history of Cyprus and the invasion, no one talks about, everyone talks about the war and the invasion and the people that were killed and whatever. No one talks about the rapes. No one talks about the woman that was stuck at home to look after the children and the elderly parents. And they needed shelter. I mean, a lot of it's happening in Europe, in Africa with Somalia. They're talking about the factions fighting. No one's talking about the women on the side that are trying to survive every day, keeping their kids, trying to keep food in the stomach of their kids, or trying to keep the elderly parents there and present. And this is all part of it. We keep on seeing the one side of the war, and we don't see the humanized, the human part of the wall.
I'll just give you an example, and it's very, very much connected to everything we've been talking about. So now in Gaza, as we all know, Gaza is going through
A nightmare.
a literal nightmare where people cannot find food to be able to eat. So we're looking at different videos that are being circulated online where people are trying different new recipes with the little that they have. These recipes at some point are going to be part of the culinary practice of the Palestinian people. And then at some point, if we don't talk about the origin of where this recipe came from and how the women were the people who went like, oh, so I have very little, how do I make this kibbeh without the actual meat? Or how do I make this menouche without the actual, I don't know, za'atar? And this, once you understand, because it's happening in front of you and in front of your eyes, once you understand that this is something that was passed on through generations, you understand history that you've learned. Like we have recipes that were like in the Mediterranean cuisine, there's a lot of recipes that are vegan or vegetarian or don't have meat. If you go back to history, because we had a lot of either wars or different experiences of displacement and all of this, like we had to invent with the little that we have, and we didn't have this much money, we didn't have this much resources, and this is how it was created. This is also part of history, and we need to be aware that all of us have an important role. All of us have something to say, and the more we are aware of it, the less silences and gaps we'll get in the future.
I actually think that's a really awesome example you just gave. That because I was in a conference last week and we had women there from Palestine and they were telling us how they are now forced to create food out of, I mean, they're making food out of cow feed. I mean, because it's, but they didn't realize the connection now that this is going to go forward as an alternative. Going to go for it and talk to it. Tell me, how did you get into this work? What inspired you to become a visual artist? The storytelling, I know, is something that I think it, us storytellers, is just in your soul. It's just something, a longing that's deep in your heart.
Look, it was at a really young age, and I think all of us when we're kids, like we have this exercise where we go like, oh, I'm bored, what do I do? And then your parents give you a piece of paper and a pen, and they're like, just draw. It started as a way for me to get to express myself because I wasn't someone who was very ease with talking about their feelings. Like I always felt like this was something that made me very fragile and vulnerable, and I didn't want to show it. And it was always like even when I wanted to say it, like if I wanted to tell someone that I loved them, something got stuck in my throat. And I don't know if you get that feeling. Like it's always something that you want to say the word, but you really feel it in your throat, like it's not coming out. So I always had to go to the pen and paper because then I could say whatever I want, or I could draw it. I could be like, okay, I'm not going to tell you, but I'm going to make a drawing for you, and then I'll give it to you, and then you'll understand by yourself. You'll be fine. It was a getaway for me. And then from that point on, it was my medium, like, because I felt like also language is not always easy for us to navigate feelings. Like sometimes you don't find the word for something that you're feeling. It's a lot of words. It's not one word. Sometimes it's an image. Like sometimes I feel stuff. When I want to explain it, I explain it in a scene. Like it's a movie scene. So I start telling you about the clouds, about the color of the sky, and this is how I'm feeling. And it was weird. Like this is how I found out that art is a way where you could put many dimensions of you, of yourself in it. And then when people see it, they might not get the same feeling that you wanted, but it's also part of what they're feeling. So you're building between yourself and the other this dimension where this speaks to them as well. And this is something that I've always been very fond of, like having my work impact someone else, or having something that someone else also feels, or it connects to them, or it speaks to their story. It was always that for me. But then going into academic pursuit of fine arts, that was different, because this is where I learned, like, you need a certain cultural capital to be able to be an artist. You need a certain circle of known people, from a curator to museum directors to other artists of a certain social class, to be able to integrate. So there was a problem between what I thought art was and what art was actually becoming. And because of this, because I'm coming from a family where, like, my dad was a bartender, then he was a waiter, then he was someone who made Lebanese street food, from falafel to menouchi to all of this. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom. So we don't come from a cultural capital thingy. And I had to work. You cannot major in fine arts and presume that you're going to be able to pay the rent with it. So you start working at a very young age, and you're like, okay, if I know these skills, how can I use them? So I went into writing about arts and culture for different newspapers. I also worked in the archives. I worked in different cultural organizations and institutions, and I built my skills in project management and in this and in that. And it was always like, if I went into a practice, I went into it thinking that, can I push the boundary a bit further for the people who cannot access arts and culture to be able to access it in a better way? And because I come from a background where I knew what it was for me a very important experience. Because people who come into the sector of the arts and culture are usually coming from other backgrounds. So they don't know as much as you know, being part of the artists, group too. So it's always a very refreshing approach when you come into it and you're like, I have the experience in working in project management, but I also come from a background as an artist. So I know what the needs, what the actual needs are. And this is where you start pushing the boundaries. Like, you don't always succeed. And at some point you go like, oh, okay, so management doesn't want this. Shut up. But
But
it's
it's
awesome.
trial and error and pushing boundaries and sometimes coming back to boundaries you had before. So it's a work in progress.
It is. But it's
Tell
very rewarding.
me, is the fact that you are migrant as well, it must have influenced you greatly as well. The fact that you've had to move around and your status hasn't been easy to manage, your official status.
So I've moved out of Lebanon in 2020 after the Beirut port explosion on
You
August 4th.
do know that we felt it in Cyprus. The day of the explosion, we thought there was an earthquake.
Yeah, and it was and like we felt it as an earthquake at first in Lebanon. It was for like 30 seconds. There was no sound. It was just the earth was shaking, and then we heard the actual sound. So it was really inexplicable.
Scary.
So I left Lebanon after the August 4, and this is where I started my other journey of starting over. So I had been working in Lebanon for 13 years. The last post I had before leaving Beirut, I was working as an arts and culture liaison for the US Embassy in Beirut. And it was like I came to a point where I had an actual career and I moved out. So then I went to France to finish my PhD. But then I realized that you cannot continue your career once you start moving. You have to start over, because elsewhere in the world, they might not recognize your experience. So you have to try and find ways to start over, and you have to accept that this is the new situation, and you can, this is the new you. You have to plan otherwise how you want to go about your career and your life. And it's very difficult, even until now, because since 2020 until now, I'm still in an unstable situation. So I go to a country with a contract. By the time the contract ends, I have to move to another country and find another way. So it's not like I'm still trying to find ways to plan without actually planning. It's hard. It's really hard. Like even when I dare to dream, let's say, if I want to say like in 10 years I want to be here, there's always this voice in my head where it goes like, girl, don't plan, you've seen what happened, don't do it, and better live as a also on a contractual dream than on a longer term plan. And it's been that way for the past couple of years.
Can I ask you something? Because we're coming towards the end of this. Is there any story you've heard or told with the grandmothers or the godmothers that actually shook you or stays with you?
There's a story, and I'm not allowed to name names. I'm gonna go
Absolutely,
vaguely in the
yes.
story. So one of the grandmothers was telling me about how she first came from Portugal to Luxembourg. And she was telling the story going like, we had to cross on foot from Portugal to Spain, from Spain to France, from France to Luxembourg. And she had her kids with her. And her brother was not allowed to come because it was a time during which in Portugal you had to serve in the military. But he wanted to accompany them just to make sure they're okay. And then he went back. So her brother made the whole way with them as if he was a stranger. He stood aside. He just wanted to make sure they're okay. Every time they crossed from one checkpoint to another, he was there. And then by the end of it, he came back. Like the guy made the whole trip just to be watching over them. And I told her, he's your guardian angel. And she was like, yeah, this is very true. This was like also one of the stories where
Makes
I
my
went
hair
like,
it makes my hair stand on end when I hear it.
yeah. And it makes you think that what happened to Portuguese in the 70s is what happened with the Syrians when they tried to cross 10 years ago. And when you start feeling the connection that if the Portuguese were not welcome in Luxembourg in the 70s, and now they're like part of the population, they're part of the culture, they're everywhere. You feel like we need to tell the Syrian refugees that are trying to make their way here that they're not alone, that this
Yes.
happened before, that it's not something that is only about them. The circumstances change, the nationalities change, our hate for different nationalities change and shift with the years. And it's very important to tell the story. When this woman was talking about her story, I also remembered another story a Syrian friend of mine told me when he moved across the borders. paid a lot of money to try and get from Vienna to Germany to settle in the Netherlands. And it was an immediate connection. Like the way she was telling me how she was crossing was the same way he was telling me how he was crossing. And the more we put these stories forward, the less it's going to be hard for the newcomers to integrate. Like they're gonna connect. They're gonna feel like it's not only me. It's
I'm
not,
not alone. It's happened
I'm not
before.
alone.
Okay. I think that's a lovely mood to finish this conversation on, unless there's something else you would like to say.
No. Actually, no, but I'm very thankful that we've had this moment to chat, and I really hope this resonates with a lot of people.
Or I tell you, it resonates with me, so we're going to pass it on. And I'm really glad we made the connection in March. Also, really glad we've had this conversation.
Thank
And
you, Magda.
our stories are similar, but they're different.
They
And
are. They
everyone,
are.
we all need to realize we're not alone. So, thank you very, very much for agreeing to come and speak with us.
Thank you.
And keep on rocking with your stories.
Sure, I'll keep you posted on
Keep me posted
the project.
and stay safe. And above all, stay safe.
Thank
Okay.
you.
Thank you, Mariama, to the listeners. Thank you for listening, and you're not alone. Keep on telling your stories.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.